Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Thursdays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Well, you
know. Our Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with my co-host, Jake Towne and Melinda Pillsbury Foster. And we have quite a few good news stories to focus on today, including a special guest coming on at the quarter past the hour. Lauren Moret's going to be talking to us about radiation and the secret menace it holds for society. But first, let's go to the headlines. And we have a lot of things to talk about, mortgage rates, Sarah Palin with her insights on the monetary system. But we're going to start off with the ongoing calamity going on in Haiti, something that we touched on when we first started the show last January. We haven't really touched on it for the last few months, but things have been getting desperate there. Not only did they get hit with a hurricane this past weekend, Hurricane Tomas, which left some 20 people dead, but now they're dealing with a cholera epidemic, which as of Tuesday the 9th, showed 724 people dead from that epidemic and over 11,000 cases being attempted to be treated in the swamped hospital and medical facilities in Haiti. Things are only getting worse there, and I bring this up, Jake and Melinda, because it strikes me that the three of us talked about what really needed to go on there, that there needed to be early efforts to engage the people who were the survivors of the crisis of the original earthquake in rebuilding their country, and to a large extent, that hasn't really happened. I mean, Jake, what's your take on this? Have you been following the news story at all? Do you see it the same way?
Yeah, I honestly haven't been following the Haiti case in general, but it's a disturbing pattern that you kind of see throughout time. Like, for instance, you know, after World War II, when you had the IMF and the World Bank out there to prevent poverty, and you were supposed to help out in Africa for many years, Africa is really not too much further along than they were back then, and many, many people obviously live in abject poverty there. And I think it does speak to the idea that, you know, foreign aid is not always helpful. It can also, you know, in an emergency scenario, maybe, but in a scenario where people come to rely on it instead of relying upon themselves and their society, you know, it just doesn't work.
And the thing that really struck me is from the beginning how the various governments that descended upon Haiti promising to solve the problems and so forth, none of them or very few of them talked about actually involving the local Haitians in their efforts. It was always going and do it for them rather than or do it to them, perhaps, rather than involving them. And Melinda, we're now seeing what's going on in terms of what the results are. They're on the verge of a total chaotic and horrible epidemic that could actually just rip through the entire population very shortly.
Well, you know, this is the sort of thing that happens if these emergencies aren't handled correctly. They could have happened in a lot of different situations that we faced in the United States, but we were a little bit more fortunate. It was easy to see that potentially happening after Katrina.
That's absolutely true. Of course, the big difference between Katrina and the Haitian earthquake is obviously the two different economies are entirely different. The Haitian economy was basically wiped out, unfortunately. So, I mean, they're just facing horrible, horrible times down there.
Well, our economy is about to be wiped out, too. So.
Yeah, we try not to think about that. But that is, of course, that's what this show is all about, isn't it? But anyway, getting back
well,
to
it's one of our subjects.
It's one of our subjects, that's right. Getting back to the headlines again, the situation with the dollar and with the mortgage crisis and so forth continues to look bleak, and of course this has turned into a rather strong rally by both gold and silver that has gotten some coverage by the media, but for the most part hasn't gotten a whole lot of coverage. However, the whole question of a gold or silver monetary influence in the overall monetary system got an unusual endorsement from a rather high-level figure, and Jake has a story about that. Jake?
Yes, Robert Zoellick, a few days ago on November 7th, wrote an op-ed for the Financial Times. And Robert Zoellick, for those who are unaware, is the leader of the World Bank. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a whole bunch of other great committees. And he's in his address or in his article, he wrote about how currency coordination has really is starting to break down. And he roughly went through the past 20 years or so of the evolution of currency talks, and at the end of the at the end of the article, probably the most interesting piece that has a lot of people talking about it, is he writes about, quote, the system should also consider employing gold as an international reference point of market expectations about inflation, deflation, and future currency values. Although TechFix may view gold as the old money, markets are using gold as an alternative monetary asset today, unquote. And that's a pretty interesting little quote, because obviously most of these Keynesian economists that have been in power for, you know, really the last, almost about the last 100 years, the last thing that they want to talk about is using gold. And I think it just understates the point that the dollar really is under quite a bit of stress. And for those bigwigs to even be tossing this idea around it really kind of says that where we might be moving into the future is more and more trouble with the dollar, and with gold at roughly an all-time high in nominal dollars of about $1,400, and with silver jumping up very, very quickly from about $20 an ounce to $27 an ounce over the past month or so. People are starting to wake up. You really haven't seen, and it would be very hard to miss it if it did happen, is a mass surge into the precious metals. But people are looking for alternatives to the dollar, and that includes the World Bank, includes all the rest of the world governments, including China and Europe, and it's something that we should all be pretty concerned about.
Absolutely true, and of course it's not just the dollar.
Did you see what happened at at the Jekyll Island reunion?
Give us enlighten us.
Actually, Alan Greenspan admitted that the American people had been robbed.
Like he did in 1966.
Yes, well, he admitted it. It was sort of nice.
Did he go into any more detail about that robbery?
No, just there's a video out there. I suggest that just go Google him and go listen to it. I don't know why nobody's written an article about it yet, but they haven't. I'm sure they will be. It's very recent.
Well, when you happen to find that video in your travels again, send me an email of it, because I'd love to see that one, that's for sure. And of course,
remember, this last week they did have the reunion for Jekyll Island.
That's right, yes. And I haven't seen any news reports about that, have you?
No, just that.
Just that, yeah.
One little tiny thing.
They kept the whole thing secret like we suggested they should, as a commemoration for the first one being so secret 100 years ago.
That's right.
Right, and what's also interesting is not all members of the Fed, the central bank, are all too happy with where things are going. Mr. Richard Fisher of the Dallas Fed, who's spoken up before about the tremendous debt over the past several years, really, he gave a little talk about the money printing or the monetization of the debt, known as quantitative easing 2, or QE2 for short, not to be confused with the Queen Elizabeth II ship. But he was also talking about the monetization of the debt. And what, let me quick see if I find this quote. It's a long, short little essay. But in a speech, he said that the Federal Reserve will buy $110 billion a month in treasuries, an amount that annualized represents the projected deficit of the federal government for the next year. For the next 8 months, the nation's central bank will be monetizing the national debt. What that means is that no longer is China or any of these other foreigners buying our debt. We're literally just printing up paper tickets. And he says, quote, this is risky business. We all know that history is littered with the economic carcasses of nations that incorporated this as a regular central bank practice. So how can the decision made last Wednesday be justified? Unquote. And then he tries to rationalize it a little bit. But for certain, I think that there are more and more central bankers that are kind of waking up to the fact that this whole currency, the currency is really the last card before the whole deck goes down.
And it isn't just the dollar either, because we're talking about all the major currencies of the world being in trouble these days. The euro has been in trouble for the last couple of years, certainly since the crisis hit. The yen, the Japanese yen, has been in trouble for like the last 20 years practically. And the other major currencies as well are really hurting. China, their yuan, despite the fact that they bought up all that gold recently, their yuan is being inflated like crazy. You know, real estate prices are just soaring over there, among other things, and they're setting themselves up for a big crash, which will undoubtedly come at some point, probably sooner than it would have come here in the United States than it did come here in the United States. Here it took 40 years or so before it finally hit. But all the major currencies, they're in trouble. And the talk these days, they don't actually talk about the details of how the whole thing works, but they refer to it in little blips and bits and bytes that you see in the news reports. And the blips and bits and bytes are about how there could be a currency war. They never actually talk about what that would consist of, but just that there could be a currency war and it could be disastrous for everybody. And I think it's important to note that what that really means is a currency war is really nothing more than each central bank in control of each currency, trying to monetize as much currency as they can to keep their own part of the economy going, and each one basically bidding down, trying to play a game of chicken as to who can push their economy the farthest, who can basically make their currency the weakest in order to attract in imports and so forth. It's a game of chicken that ends up in monetary disaster, and everybody knows about it. Of course, nobody actually admits that this is what's leading up to, but they make references to it. Meanwhile, meanwhile, that paragon of economic virtue who understands everything about the monetary system, Sarah Palin, weighing in this past week in her Facebook page about how President Obama has been acting very foolishly in terms of supporting the Federal Reserve's new round of quantitative easing. She had some very harsh words to say about it. She said, let's just read the first two paragraphs. She said, in his press conference on Monday, President Obama responded to critics of the Federal Reserve's decision to start a new round of quantitative easing, a fancy term for printing money out of thin air. He claimed this move would drive up U.S. growth rates. He also warned that the worst thing that could happen to the world economy, not just ours, but the entire world's economy, is if we end up being stuck with no growth or very limited growth. This latter is certainly true, she writes. It would be a global disaster if the U.S. economy remained permanently stuck in the mud. But the same cannot be said of his claim that the Fed's experiment in pump priming would automatically lead to increased economic growth. By the time this experiment is over, QE will make us queasy. And, of course, conservative supporters are jumping on board saying, look how educated and informed she is about the monetary system and so forth, and she's absolutely saying the right things. Until you get to the end of her little piece in which she says, if the president was serious about getting the economy moving again, he'd stop supporting the Fed's dangerous experiments with our currency and focus instead on what actually works, reducing government spending and boosting business investment through good old-fashioned supply-side reforms, cutting taxes and reducing overly burdensome regulations. Simply running the printing presses in order to avoid paying off your debts is no way for a great nation to behave. Well, that's true, but the question still remains, what does she understand about how the monetary system works? And once again, she basically demonstrates that she doesn't really understand any of it. She says the right things, she says the right words, but she doesn't seem to fully get the monetary system. Are you reading this differently?
She's a politician.
Well, she's a very good politician.
She's reading her script, for gosh sake.
That's right, and it makes me wonder who wrote it for her.
Maybe it was John Fund. He does a lot of that.
I don't know. What I do know is she's given no indication that she understands the nature of debt-based money. In fact, let me share a little story with you before we go to break, because we're about to go to break and then bring our guest on. But I went to speak before a local 912 group in Fairfax, Virginia. Fairfax, of course, is right outside of Washington, D.C., and they have a fairly well-established 912 group there. I went to speak to them because I was promoting my book, The Money Suckers. First of all, as I prepared for it, and then as I went up in front to speak to them at their meeting, I kind of went in thinking, these guys probably know a lot about the things I'm going to be talking about anyway, so I'll probably be kind of preaching to the choir, at least on some points. That was my expectation walking in. Well, I sat down, introduced myself, talked a little bit about my background and how I ended up writing the book and what my motivations were, and I said, my main purpose in writing the book and in doing this little speaking tour is I want to try to educate Americans about the nature of our monetary system and how it actually contributed to the financial crisis. I suspect I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, but let's just go over it anyway. And I started off by saying, who here can tell me what debt-based money is? Now, there were about 20 to 25 people in the room, and I found out later that they included graduates of Cornell, Columbia, Radcliffe, Vassar, many of the top colleges in the country, and not one person in that room knew the term debt-based money. I continued trying to press them a little bit, like give them little clues and so forth, seeing if I could leave them there. And one gentleman almost got there. He started talking about how the banks do actually create money out of thin air through the deposit process and how it tends to multiply the money supply. He came the closest. But do you know what? Nobody in that group could tell me what debt-based money is. And it made me wonder if that's what one fairly significant 912 group has to say about their knowledge of how the monetary system works. What does it say about the Tea Party movement as a whole? I mean, my impression is that
question is, what does it tell us about college graduates?
Well, that too. But I just thought that was the most striking thing. Supposedly, the Tea Party is up in arms about the financial crisis and about the bailouts and all this other kind of thing, and how it is just a complete travesty and so forth. And yet, they don't seem to understand the basics of the system itself. It was an eye-opening experience. Well, we're going to take a break because we have a guest coming on in a few minutes. Laura Murray is going to come to talk to us about radiation and how it's going to affect our future survival. So we'll be back to hear from her in just a few minutes. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network.
Talk about destruction. Don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be?
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
What will be the impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Well, you know. We are back here on the Freedom News Hour, and Melinda, why don't you introduce our guest for today?
Well, and that's a real pleasure because Lauren Moray has been an expert witness at the International Criminal Tribune for Afghanistan, and she's also on the organizing committee of the World Committee on Radiation Risk. She has been an expert witness all over the world on the secret plague that confronts all of us, and that is radiation. So without any more introduction, it's my pleasure to welcome Lauren Moray. Lauren, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us today. I know that you have witnessed tremendous things and an awakening on those issues. How did that start for you?
Well, I've worked in two nuclear weapons labs. I'm a geoscientist. And in 1991, I became a whistleblower at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab. That is about 45 minutes east of San Francisco Bay. And I really didn't know anything about radiation until about the year 2000. Geologists use it to date rocks and geologic structures and so forth. But when you work in a nuclear weapons lab, they absolutely never mention it, because if they told people how dangerous it is, they couldn't get anyone to work in their bomb factories. So I met Marion Falk, who was a Manhattan Project scientist. He worked later in his career at the Livermore Lab. And I met him in a community radiation organization office. And I became very good friends with him. And I began studying with him in his home. And it took him 10 years, but he finally told me 2 months ago. Now, remember, I started working with him in the year 2000. 2 months ago, he finally told me he had solved the problems on the U.S. hydrogen bomb and made it possible to make one and successfully detonate it. That was a very surprising secret, but he has taught me things that you can never, ever learn ever in a university and even less likely in a nuclear weapons lab about the biological and environmental effects of radiation. And what has happened is that a hidden global genocide has been taking place since 1945 because of global pollution of the biosphere with ionizing radiation. And this has accelerated dramatically since 1990 when the United States introduced depleted uranium weapons to the battlefield in Iraq in Gulf War I. And the effects are not just in Iraq, they're global. And because I'm a geoscientist, I began mapping diseases like diabetes and Parkinson's and Lou Gehrig's and very strange birth defects like Siamese twins. They're actually called conjoined twins, but most people know them as Siamese twins. And there was an epidemic of conjoined twins in the U.S. during nuclear bomb tests between about 1957 and 63. Well, now there's an epidemic of conjoined twins in Iraq, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, where on the battlefield the U.S. and Britain and NATO forces, especially in Yugoslavia and Afghanistan, have used tremendous amounts of depleted uranium. And
we've known that for a while, right? I remember an article I think you contributed to in the Iconoclast about the cloud that was going from Iraq actually all the way to Scotland.
Well, that's just the airflow in one direction. It actually takes it across the entire Eurasian continent, and then depending on the weather, it deposits this radiation. These are nanoparticles of high-temperature uranium oxides, and they end up in the environment, and, for instance, it's caused an esophageal cancer epidemic along the Silk Road, the ancient Silk Road, from Central Asia, the Middle East, Central Asia, into northern China. And then it comes across the Pacific, and there are many people suddenly dying of, for instance, pancreatic cancer in the United States. And Michael Douglas has a very aggressive cancer on the back of his tongue right now. He's really literally fighting for his life. And I'll bet you anything that is caused by depleted uranium from Iraq and Afghanistan, because he spends a lot of time in Spain and in Mediterranean countries, as well as I believe he lives in Bermuda. So that's right in the path of the hurricanes that all originate in the Sahara Desert, of the hurricanes. And so they're loaded with radiation. And any place that the monsoon rains out this radiation, it's across Africa, it's South Africa, it's throughout Southeast Asia, it's in Australia, and then, of course, it goes right across to the north India, goes over the Himalayas and continues across China, Taiwan, and Japan. And so that's how I got involved in it. And I have to tell you, Melinda, it's the most interesting topic I have ever been involved in.
It's certainly the best to be one of the most frightening.
It's horrible. It is horrible. Melinda, we have over a million disabled, medically disabled American soldiers. A lot of them are National Guardsmen and the reserves, like the Army Reserves. Mm-hmm. And these are weekend soldiers who had no idea what they were getting into. They are simply radioactive cannon fodder. The government and the Pentagon are fully aware of it. And the most important thing is four families, grandparents, aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters to counter-recruit in the high schools all over America. That's been the biggest deterrent to these healthy young men and women joining the military. And 2 months later, they're mentally ill from the radiation. At such high levels in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And when they come back, actually, their wives start having babies with birth defects, right? They're actually then carrying it.
Oh, well, they have the depleted uranium all over in their bodies. These are male and female soldiers. The male soldiers have something called burning semen from the chemical changes to the semen from the uranium, and they are internally contaminating their wives and partners. And then, of course, the babies are born with very severe birth defects. But the poor soldiers cannot get out of the military because the illnesses would be considered a pre-existing condition by any health insurance company, so they couldn't get any health care. And so they have to remain silent and stay in the military until they get kicked out because they're too sick to be useful as soldiers. They're just tossed in the garbage can.
That is so horrifying.
Well,
is there anything that can be done to them? Are there any ways of treating it?
There's no way to treat it. Absolutely no way to treat it. These are nanoparticles that are so tiny, they don't even obey the laws of gravity. They're not influenced by gravity. They float all over the world like tiny radioactive balloons, and they're blown all over, carried on air currents. And so you and I and Walt are breathing those particles right now.
How do we detect them, or how are they detected? How do we know that they're there, and how do we know how much is there?
You have to use a Geiger counter. I have one in my purse or briefcase. And, for instance, I went to Hawaii, and I wanted to get the state legislatures to start passing depleted uranium bills, not because I really thought they were going to do anything, but it's a great way to publicize the issue to many more people. And so I went to New Orleans in 2005, and this Vietnam veteran heard me talking and asked me to be in a parade. And so we marched through New Orleans, and he walked up to me when I was talking on the footsteps of the Louisiana Supreme Court building, and he said, give me that bill. A legislator in Connecticut had written a bill for DU. It was the very first one, and she couldn't get it passed. So he grabbed it out of my hand. He went and got another veteran who was not a Vietnam veteran, but they went to the state legislature together. You won't believe it, Walt. In 3 months, the governor passed that and signed it. into law. That was the very first state bill, and it spread all over to other states. I mean, I didn't even do anything except to hand that to him. And then in 2007, I went to Hawaii for 3 months because I wanted to get depleted uranium into the Hawaiian legislature because there's so many military there. And I had my Geiger counter with me. I went to Kona on the Big Island. I drove from Hilo to Kona with my Geiger counter through the military facility. It's a bombing and gunnery range called Pohakaloa. And the red flags were up that day. The main road goes right through the base. And we drove into Kona and down the Kona coast, 35 miles. And I said, oh, heck, why don't I just turn on the Geiger counter and see if I can get anything? Because I knew they were shooting live DU that day. And I flipped it on, and you won't believe it, Walt, it was beginner's luck. The radiation levels were 9 to 11 times higher than normal. And we had stopped at a Walmart or something and just put a video camera on a credit card in case we got something. And we videotaped it, me making the readings. I flew to Honolulu. It went on television, and it completely destroyed the credibility of all military in Hawaii. I educated the public. I emailed the cancer map for Hawaii to everyone. The governor was in an uproar. The legislators were in uproar. Everybody was trying to shut me up. But I had started a citizen Geiger counter movement. I had citizens sitting in their homes with Geiger counters plugged into their computers, and they got a court-admissible scientific record of radiation levels for 5 months. They were taking measurements every second.
Wow.
And that was so powerful that the police chief of New York City panicked because New York City is still radioactive from 9/11, and he tried to get a law passed in New York City that no citizens could own Geiger counters, air monitors, or use them. It failed.
When was this law introduced? Or this?
This was about 2008, and it was absolutely because of the movement I started. I mean, people all over the world were contacting me and asking me to come and start the Geiger counter movement in Australia and Canada and countries all over the world. And the reason the governments have gotten away with global pollution from radiation and hiding the diseases, diabetes is one of the main ones, is because the government health departments, the government environmental departments, the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, the EPA, the state and county environmental facilities have made the measurements, and they've manipulated and fiddled all the data to hide the radiation levels. When the citizens started measuring themselves, the legislators said to the governor, stop them right away because they're going to make mistakes and they shouldn't be measuring the radiation. And so the citizens came to me and I said, look, Geiger counters don't make mistakes. All you're doing is standing there and holding it, or you're plugging it in your computer. That is a court admissible scientific record.
What's been going on because of that? I mean, now they know that they've got a problem. Are there citizens groups working on this, veterans groups?
Oh, it's still an uproar. In fact, I just got an email today from Hawaii, and the Army at Schofield Barracks, which is outside of Honolulu on the island of Oahu near Pearl Harbor, they've been bombing and shooting with DU since the 60s, and the whole entire environment is radioactive. It's all the plants and the leaves and the soil. It's all contaminated, and they announced that they were going to burn thousands of acres of vegetation around Schofield Barracks, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said, no, you're not. You are not going to burn that. You do not have authority to do it or permission to do it, and you will remobilize all that radiation, all that depleted uranium will go up in smoke and recycle all through the environment and people's lungs and bodies. You'll contaminate everybody on this island.
Lauren, while you were talking there, I did a little search online to learn more about that 2008 incident with Mayor Bloomberg and found an article in the Village Voice, which, of course, is a major alternative paper there, in which they discussed what had been proposed. The author of the article, Chris Thompson, in his first paragraph said, here's another, damn you, Osama bin Laden, here's another thing you've done to us. After 9/11, untold thousands of New Yorkers bought machines that detect traces of biological, chemical, and radiological weapons. But a lot of these machines didn't work right, and when they registered false alarms, the police had to spend millions of dollars chasing bad leads and throwing the public into a state of panic. So my question for you is that true? Is it true that a lot of the devices that are inexpensively purchased are not accurate?
No, the devices are absolutely accurate because this has happened to me. The police and the military are manipulating those radiation and chemical detectors with electromagnetic frequencies to disrupt the accurate measurements. They've done it to me.
How does that actually work, using electronic frequencies? Can you describe that?
Well, the anything that is electrical, even our own bodies are electrical systems. Detectors have batteries in them, and so they manipulate the batteries and the functioning of the different the software actually for the detectors. They can do it to anything now. All electronic devices manufactured since 1995 have hidden secret antennas in them. And it's so that the military and the police can turn off your computer, turn it on, turn off your printer, disable it. If they don't like what you're doing, they just disable your printer. And they've even demonstrated on TV where they can just transmit a radio wave to a car and stop it dead in the middle of the road.
And how do we know that these secret antennas are in there?
Because it's the law that all electronic devices manufactured in the U.S. since 1995 must have a secret antenna in them.
But if it's a law, how is it secret?
Because
people don't know about it. Do you remember that what was happening with the telephones, that they were older phones, cell phones, and they were like the pay-as-you-go phones? And Muslims that were
prepaid
around and bought the prepaids, and they were buying them. That was because they didn't have the tracking device in them.
The GPS.
The GPS.
Can you cite the particular law? Because I have to admit that's a law I'm not familiar with.
I'm sorry, what?
Can you cite that particular law? Because I have to admit that's a law I've never heard of. I'm not familiar with
it. I don't know what the law is. I read about it. I was horrified. And there are lots of laws that we don't know anything about.
Well, it sounds like one we should know about, that we need to know more
Absolutely
about.
Absolutely, we should know about it. In fact, you can contact IEEE. It's the International Electrical Engineers Organization, and they've been instrumental in designing these electronic weapons. In fact, HAARP, the latest weapon of mass destruction, was developed under the Cold War secretly with the Soviet Union, and the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab, where I worked, was the main partner. And it's a weapon of mass destruction system that weaponizes the entire atmosphere. The whole magnetic field is part of their weapon of mass destruction. And they have developed it so they can carry out mind control anywhere in the world from huge antennas. There's one, a U.S. one in Alaska. There's one in Tromsø, Norway, that is British. There's one on Cyprus, that's British. There's one in Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan. I don't know whose that is. It could be Soviet or Russians. There's one in Australia. There's one in Antarctica. There's one in Peru. There's an American one in Puerto Rico at Arecibo, and the U.S. Navy triggered the Haiti earthquake. This weapon of mass destruction, HAARP, can carry out secret tectonic warfare. It can carry out weather warfare. It can carry out mind control, and there are other applications that we don't even know about.
And how do we know about these different locations?
What research?
Well, obviously somebody did some research, but I mean, where's the factual evidence of them? I just have never heard of them, so I'd like to know what the factual evidence is.
Well, it's government documents. I only use government documents to prove what I'm saying.
Okay. Can you cite some of them?
No, I can't cite them. You have to do a search on the Internet for HAARP, HAARP. And you can use my name, Loren, Leuren. And the talks that I give in interviews and so forth usually have an outline of my talk with links to the sources of my information.
Yeah, actually, I can send you, Walt, some links to her sites if you'd like.
Well, I don't have a site. People post my stuff all over the Internet, and what I'll do is send links to about 15 or 20 HAARP interviews that I've done to Melinda, and you can post it on your website.
Okay. Well, why don't you share your website with our listeners so they can check into it ourselves, because we're kind of at the end of the segment here anyway. So tell us.
I don't have a website. I just said
it'll
I don't
be
have
up on NATAC, NATAC dot NATAC.
NATAC.org,
I think.
Okay. Well, Loren, thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate it. Thank you for sharing the information. We'll be doing some research to learn more about it.
Yeah, I'm sure
it
sounds absolutely unbelievable. But, you know, Mark Twain said, truth is stranger than fiction. Fiction, after all, has to make sense.
All right, very good. Well, thanks once again. And we'll take a break, and we'll be back after a minute or two to carry you to the top of the hour. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network.
Change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Eric Offner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
I'm Elaine Snuffa, host-producer of Evolving Ideas, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E at GaryKnoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds. You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, and a very interesting segment there. I look forward to seeing what the more factual evidence is, but she certainly raised some interesting issues there, Melinda.
Yes, she did, and of course I'm familiar because I have read quite a few of her articles, and it is very interesting. I first got to know Lorraine through Leon Smith, who does the Iconoclast, and that was she was one of the sources, as I had indicated, for the information that came out about the DU in sort of rolling across Europe and all the way up into Scotland. That was one of the indicators that actually, until then, that we're talking back around 2004, Americans, people simply were not aware that DU was being used as a weapon.
Well, we're going to have to do some more research, but it certainly sounds like something we all need to know about, because obviously if radiation is spreading, that's something that we need to know.
Yes, actually I may be able to still find the pictures of babies born in Iraq. There have been many, many, many of the co-joined babies born there. I mean, when you take a look at what has gone on and how many of them are taking place in something that used to be extremely rare, it is nauseating and shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And well, another thing, of course, is veterans groups are reporting this, that veterans coming home are having a higher incidence of these births in their own families.
Do you have a source of that, or are you just doing that off the top of your head?
No. In terms of the source is somebody that I talked to who had experienced it.
Oh, okay. So you actually
There are groups out there that they're, because they need cope. They need to cope when it mm-hmm. happens. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they come together as a group and share resources, including information about what they can do, because then they're looking at some real medical issues.
Absolutely true. Medical issues are a major part of returning veterans' lives, and that this appears to be another example of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, meanwhile, part of everybody else's lives is the continuing ongoing economic crisis, and as usual, I've been perusing the headlines and the Google News and so forth, trying to find any slight bit of evidence that the major media are starting to latch on to the question of mortgage resets. And just to summarize for listeners who may not remember why resets are so important, mortgage resets are what triggered the financial crisis of 2008. The subprimes, they peaked in terms of the number of resets in the early fall of 2008, and that's what basically led to the massive panic and the fears that the major banks are going to fail, and the failures of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and so on and so forth. Well, the next round of mortgage resets is set to peak in the fall of 2011, which is why here on the Freedom News Hour we've talked persistently about that and about the other factors leading to a potential monetary meltdown. So that's why I keep perusing the news, and I actually found something interesting that was published today by Mark Koba of CNBC. Now, the headline leads you to believe that everything may be well, all may be well, but the rest of the article I thought was quite intriguing, so let me read the whole thing to you. The headline is, "Big Wave of Mortgage Resets May Not Be As Bad as Feared," by Mark Koba, CNBC. Here's what he had to say. "The much-anticipated wave of adjustable-rate mortgage resets, which are beginning to hit many homeowners now, may not be as devastating to the housing market as experts had feared. I don't see much of a payment shock as long as interest rates remain low," says Frank Nothaft, chief economist at Freddie Mac. "The Fed has been moderating policy," he says, "and keeping rates low for treasuries to serve as an index for adjustable-rate mortgages. I think that will continue into the end of 2011. Over the last 2 years, many industry analysts were expecting the large number of ongoing adjustable-rate mortgage term changes to have a crushing effect on the market, on the housing market, with increases on interest rate payments as well as principal, forcing thousands more foreclosures than are already taking place. But historically low interest rates are reversing that expectation. In fact, Millsap says some adjustable-rate mortgage holders might even see their interest rates lowered when the loans term when the loan terms change. That's not to say everyone with an adjustable-rate mortgage will see the rates go down, but some will, as the rates have continued to fall for those adjustable-rate mortgage indexes, Millsap added. However, and this is where the article changes, even with the increases in payment, in principal, which are included in some ARMs, adjustable-rate mortgages, homeowners might not take as much of a hit, says Mark Schwaber, corporate development manager mortgage for First Choice Loan Services in New Jersey. I have no idea who dreams up these titles. One side may go up the principal, but on the other side, the interest rates will more likely go down with the new terms, Schwaber goes on to say. I think it balances out more or less. Still, some analysts are continuing to warn about the dangers of ARM borrowers and the housing market. Quote, a lot of ARMs were interest-only payments, and the principal balances are going to increase as the loan terms restructure in the days ahead, says Rick Sharga, vice president of RealtyTrack.com. People who have those types of ARMs are going to see big increases in their housing costs. I don't think many of them will be able to afford it. Starting this quarter, nearly 1 million adjustable-rate mortgages are estimated to be reset into higher payments over the next 3 years, with some 750,000 of them adjusting now and through 2011. They will reach a peak next year of 54,000 adjustments just in the month of August. Sharga says that about half of all those ARM loans will see their principal costs rise, what's called recasting, along with possible interest rate hikes or resetting. Quote, about $300 billion in ARMs will reset and recast in higher payments in 2011, Sharga goes on to say. I think this is a potentially toxic situation for homeowners and for the market with more foreclosures on the line. Option ARMs primarily offer homeowner loans at a much lower initial interest than a fixed mortgage for, say, a 3 to 6 year period. Buyers can even get interest-only ARM loans and skip principal payments for a time, but the terms eventually change, and both principal and or interest rates usually go up. While some experts might downplay the effect of ARM resets, option ARM loans have been somewhat of a thorn in housing side during the real estate crisis. That's because the delinquency rate is still high as the terms change, as in the foreclosure rate. So I'm not sure how you guys read it. I read it that the media are trying to spin. They're trying to convince us it all as well, but they just can't quite do it 100%. Jake, is that the way you see it?
That's a good way of putting it.
And I suspect we're going to see more and more of that as time goes on, but right now you have to really rake through the news files to find anything about recess, because so far they're just being ignored entirely.
Well, there's so many different things that they ignore because they simply don't want to talk about them, and you have to remember you're talking to the mainstream media, right?
Absolutely, and that's part of their job, isn't it, to shield us from the most important stuff. Well,
yes,
on the lighter side, of course, it's somewhat of a sad day, but it's also a celebratory day because it is Veterans Day. And Jake has a report for us about Veterans Day. Jake?
Sure. Today is November 11th, Veterans Day, as it has been known since 1954. But what a lot of people don't quite realize is that it was signed it was initially called Armistice Day on the day that ended World War One, where the World War One was ended on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918. When the Germans signed the Armistice Agreement, which then led to World War II. But it was initially dedicated as a holiday to world peace, and here in the United States it's, of course, gone on to honor our veterans today. And I think that it's worth, you know, it's kind of funny how things change, because Armistice or World Peace Day or that sort of thing is unfortunately quite a bit different than Veterans Day. When you take a look and read about what these veterans have said, you know, the ones that have been around, there's only one American veteran from World War One that is still alive. He's 109 years old. His name is Frank Buckles. And when he was asked about his service, he said about what he thought about, you know, having Veterans Day ceremonies in 2007 while the United States was still at war. He replied, quote, I'm no authority, but I'm not in favor of war unless it's an emergency, unquote. So he's politely saying that he was not in favor of both the entire war on terror. And if you take a look at Great Britain, their last combat veteran passed away last year at the age of 111. And one of the things he posted throughout his life in his autobiography is that he hadn't had to kill anyone. And he said, quote, war isn't worth one life. It is calculated and condoned slaughter of human beings. So it's in one of his books, an autobiography, suggested that the politicians who took us to war should be given the guns and told to settle their differences themselves instead of organizing nothing better than legalized mass murder. So it's pretty interesting to see different thoughts on warfare and serving the country. Another one that people are probably a little bit more familiar with is War is a Racket by the highest decorated Marine in United States history, Smedley Butler, who wrote about how, you know, pretty much war is just a racket and just keeps on going. So I think it's worth a moment of, you know, to remember our veterans, yes, but also to remember that peace is where we really need to get to.
And very significant that the last surviving member of the original World War One had that message for us. Very, very useful information. Thank you. And Melinda, we're going to turn to you for the last minute and a half or so. Tell us what's been going on within your family.
Well, it's one in my family is one way of looking at it. I was quoted in the New York Times on Tuesday, and there have been several more articles since, and I know there are a few more that are being written now on the issue of the Ansel Adams 65 glass plate negatives that Norsegian, actually a man, had found 65 of them at a garage sale, paid $45 for them in 2000. I viewed them in 2002, and what we're doing is going through a process here of proving that they actually were done by my grandfather. Up on our site right now.
And your grandfather is?
My grandfather's name was Arthur C. Pillsbury.
Okay.
There are some very interesting quotes when you scroll down. We're going to be doing some more work on that part of the site. He had actually in 1926 addressed 32,000 people across the country, including the president and his wife, on the different things that he was doing. He invented the first lapse time camera for plants so you could see a flower blooming. And in 1927, he invented the first microscopic motion picture camera. He did that at a borrowed lab at Berkeley.
Wow.
And then did, showed the movies as part of a lecture series he was doing. He did that every year, and every year he went out to more people, which included the National Geographic Society every year in Washington, D.C. But he was also the photographer in Yosemite. And when I looked at these, I knew that he had probably 80,000 negatives in his collection. And when I looked at these, I said, these very clearly could be my grandfather's. There was a numbering system that went through it, expressed on some envelopes. And what's happened here is a complete refusal on the part, which you will see when you look at it, of the people involved to look at my grandfather as a possibility.
Wow.
And now they are being hit by the evidence, because the evidence is we're doing 17 or 18 different individual analyses of the pictures based on existing evidence.
We're out of time, so I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but keep us abreast and bring it up on the next week's program, because I'm sure this will be very interesting. That's it. We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour. Goodbye, everybody.
Take care.
Bye. You tell me that it's evolution.